Hello and good day, and welcome to another episode of This Week in Testing. Just checking my notes, this is episode number 46, so we're getting ever closer to that big 50. So thanks for sticking around, folks. I really appreciate it. And I see there's a number of people who keep returning to this, and that's lovely, absolutely lovely that you're up for listening in. And also to those folks who keep coming back to jump on stage to share some things with the community. So how this works, if you are new to This Week in Testing, I'll do a bit of a debrief for about 15 minutes or so, sharing some things that we've observed about the testing community here at Ministry of Testing. And then there'll be an opportunity to come up on stage and have a conversation. You could share something that you've been working on this week, maybe something that you read that you found really interesting, or maybe an event that you attended and you'd like to share some things that you took away from that event. Or maybe you've got a challenge that you're facing and you want to pop up on stage and ask a question to the audience and, you know, hopefully find some answers to your questions. Great. So just be mindful, if you do pop up on stage, be aware that we have a code of conduct in place. You can access that at ministryoftesting.com. Look for the link in the footer for the code of conduct. Great. So let's get stuck in. My list, wowzers, it's a mega list. So I'm not going to have a chance to go through all this, but you will be able to read the list of things that have been happening by signing up to the newsletter. So if you head over to ministryoftesting.com/newsletter, you can add your email address and then we will email you that newsletter every Monday morning. We also host it on our website, ministryoftesting.com. And for those who follow the LinkedIn newsletter by Ministry of Testing, you can also get access to that every Monday. So it's a good way to, how should I describe it? Kind of get a sense of what's been happening in the community for that week. So let's start at the top. So yeah, lots of good community things. So kind of shout out to Rafaela Acevedo. She spoke at Ministry of Testing Athens the other week and did a write-up of her key takeaways at the event. So yeah, really, really good one. If you find her blog post or look Rafaela Acevedo up on LinkedIn. Just as a like kudos to Petros Plakogiannis, who is the main organizer of Ministry of Testing Athens and the team of volunteers behind it. They really do put on an incredible meetup. So big shout out to them, a wonderful community based in Greece. Talking to communities of practice, we're starting to put out, or we have put out some polls related to communities of practice. We've got a couple on the go at the moment, which we'd love you to share your thoughts about. We posted them on LinkedIn, X, and on the club. So the club is our forum. We have questions such as, does your organization have a testing community of practice? How often do you meet with an internal testing community of practice? And also, what's most valuable in a community of practice? So yeah, go find them if you can. Again, there'll be links in the newsletter. Yet there's some really good comments coming through, folks sharing their experiences with communities of practice, but you know, internal ones that they have within their organization and how they get value from having them. So that's very cool. And I guess a bit of a sneak peek, next week I'll be recording a session with three wonderful community members. So AJ Wilson, Christine Pinto, and Stuart Day. And we are going to look at the polls. We're going to look at the results, share our thoughts and ideas, and then that will then be played the week after at the Testing Planet. So we have a half-day event on communities of practice. We've got a couple of talks. We've got a discussion, like a bit of a fireside chat. And then you'll also get this news update that we're going to record next week. So yeah, look out for that one. You can find that on our events page, ministryoftesting.com/events. Talk about people who contribute. I won't share their names because kind of respect and privacy, but there have been a number of contributors recently who Ministry of Testing will pay for their contributions, whether they're writing articles or doing talks or getting involved in various other ways. These people also have the option of donating their fee to a scholarship fund that we have, which enables folks who aren't in a position to pay for things to get access to various things with Ministry of Testing. So yeah, we've had loads of people donating their fees recently. So it really is wonderful. You know, these folks are saying, you know what, I'm going to give back. You know, that's where they got to in their career. And yeah, much respect for those people. So thank you so much for those that continue to contribute their fees to the scholarship fund. And you can learn about how you might contribute. We have now a continuous call for contributions at the moment. If you look for ministryoftesting.com/blog, you'll see a brilliant post from the CEO and co-founder of Ministry of Testing, Rosie Sherry. She describes why we've moved to a continuous call for contributions model and how you can get involved. So yeah, do go check that one out. Cool, okay. We also had, when was it? It was yesterday. Blimey, it was only yesterday. We ran an event called the Test Exchange, which is a lovely way for us to gather as a community. It's an interactive workshop. And a good bunch of people got involved and they met each other for the first time. They openly shared what help they needed, what skills they could offer each other. Yeah, just great way to get the community together. So, and thank you to Mahati Dandimhotla and Viviane Lirio for sharing some kind words publicly on LinkedIn. They were part of the session. It was cool to meet Viviane for the first time, actually. And Mahati, just wonderful that she was involved, a huge community contributor doing so much for the Ministry of Testing community and beyond. So it was great that she was part of it as well. A couple more meetups been happening this week. Russell Thomas was celebrating a successful Ministry of Testing Coventry meetup, as was Dave Rutt, who had a successful meetup in Nottingham. And hot off the press, literally before I went live, we have just revived the Ministry of Testing Glasgow meetup. So if you head over to ministryoftesting.com/meetups, you'll see a whole list of local meetups that are happening across the globe. But yeah, if you're able to get to the Glasgow region or get to Glasgow, do register for that meetup page and it will send you notifications when new events go live. We also now add all meetups that we host across the globe to our events page. So check out ministryoftesting.com/events. Brilliant. Quick time check. Got about 5 minutes before we start bringing folks up on stage. Good stuff happening in the world of automation. A lot of people have been taking the Ministry of Testing certificate in test automation, the various three levels that we have. So big shout out to folks who are getting their certificates. In particular, Tamara Joston, who was publicly sharing that they'd got theirs. Very cool. It's cool to see your certificate shared. And also, a thank you to Kelly Kenyon, Christoph Van Kriegenjen, Mark Winteringham, and Adam McCannum. Apologies for that. Those folks are doing brilliant things. So you take the course. If you've got any questions, you can ask your question on the club. And those people I've just mentioned have just gathered around people who are struggling or maybe unsure what to do next to get things working. And they jump on it, they ask questions, they offer solutions. So yeah, thank you so much to those who have, you know, some of those people have taken the course and now they're helping the people that are going through the course for the first time. So it's lovely, lovely way for them to give back. So thanks so much for that. Okie dokes, what else we got going on? Interesting post from Jiri Novacek over on the club. And the title is called, What is your third why for AI? And I found this a very curious exercise. If you head over to the club, look for what is your third why for AI? Essentially asking you to say, you know, why do I or do I not want to use AI? And then you answer it. And then you say, you know, why is the thing that I've just said important to me? And then you go, why is the thing I've just said again important to me? And you go through this three-step exercise to get you closer to your current belief system about AI and testing, you know, your why you might want to use it and why you might not want to use it. So yeah, really cool exercise, worth checking out. I gave it a go and maybe it took me about 5 minutes or so to do it. So if you've got a spare 5 minutes, it's a fun little exercise, actually. The power of why. So yeah, thank you, Jiri Novacek, for putting that out there. It's really good. So you can find that on the club. So club.ministryoftesting.com. Another great question I thought from Hanan Rayman over on the club was a bug slips past your eye. What did you do? So it a really powerful post where folks are sharing their stories about, you know, when a production bug happens, what can we learn from that? What might we have done differently? So, some good honesty coming through from the folks replying to that. And I think, you know, we're all fallible. We're all going to make mistakes. We're going to let bugs, you know, I say let bugs go through, but maybe that's the wrong way of framing it these days. But more like things are going to happen on production that were perhaps we didn't foresee. So I think there's, you know, good lessons to be shared about that. So good on Hanan for starting that conversation over on the club. It's worth checking out. Excellent. Okay, well, I'm going to stop there. And yeah, I'd love to hear from you in the audience, actually. What things have you been up to this week? What tools have you been experimenting with, perhaps, if you want to talk about tools? What things are you doing with your community of practice? If there's things that you're up to, are they, you know, are you running events? Are you sharing information in a certain way? Are you doing talks and presentations? I'd love to hear about it. I'd love to find out how you run your communities of practice within your company, or how you participate, and then how you can bring stuff in from the wider community of practice that is Ministry of Testing and beyond back into your organizations. So yeah, please do pop up on stage. You can put your hand up. I'll see that up here on my screen, and then we can have a conversation and go from there. So Paul, brilliant. Let's get Paul up on stage.
Hi,
Paul. Thanks for joining us. How's your week in testing been?
Oh, it's been good. Thank you. How's yours?
It's been a good one. What's going on? But it's been
All right, cool. Thanks. I just wanted to just talk about something that I've been pondering over for the past couple of weeks. I work in a startup. My last couple of jobs have been in sort of mid-stage startups. And one of the things I started mulling over is how startups kind of have different priorities and do things differently to larger companies when it comes to things like quality. And depending on how early the startup is. For example, you know, there was this mantra at Facebook, quite a famous mantra they used to have until the mid 2010s, move fast and break things. And this idea that in early startups, and I'm thinking about this myself because I've been listening to a bunch of Y Combinator interviews where they're talking about how startups get their first release out. Often they're faced with problems such as they don't have a budget, or they're, you know, before they go for funding rounds, they don't have much in the resources and they have to get something out very quickly, where they don't know what the market is or what users really want. And the point is to get feedback. So for them, often the priority is to get something out before the competitors do. And so therefore, sometimes they tend to, you know, sometimes they try and cram everything in and sort of, this is early stage startup, so, you know, not exactly the places I've worked, but, you know, they sometimes have to neglect quality because they don't have a dedicated QA. Often it's just like two or three founders. Only one of them's a tech founder. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of resources for them in those situations where they are so pressed for time and so pressed for budget and maybe lacking those skills. I'm sorry, that was a bit of a ramble. I apologize. But it's got me thinking a lot because there are certain things about startup culture that are pretty unique when it comes to things like quality.
I appreciate you sharing that, Paul. And if it helps, no need to apologize for that. I appreciate everything you have to share, Paul. And yeah, fascinating, right? And that switch of situation that you're now in, given your experience within like a non, you know, early stage startup environment, you know, has it been a considerable shift for you, or is there some things that you can take from your previous experiences that can actually support folks? You can still help them move fast. You can still help them kind of try and find their product market fit.
Indeed. We've definitely got product market fit, and we have, you know, paying clients and things where I'm at the moment. And we have we've got a fairly tight QA system that we, you know, in terms of how we, when we do testing, you know, we have we've got a lot of API automation. We don't have as much as UI automation as I'd like, but we're getting there. We're quite strict on making sure we do regression tests, exploratory tests, things like that. So, you know, but I think that when I first before I got into startups here in Australia, I worked in banking and insurance. And for example, we used to have quite long phases for even things like regression and PVT. And when I tried to import those, you know, we would basically do everything again, because that's the kind of environments I used to work in that were quite regulated, and that's what the, you know, the clients expected. But putting that into startups meant that everything kind of slowed down. And they were when they wanted to increase this release cadence. And at the time, they didn't have a lot of automation. So I had to, be very focused on risk, and be willing to, you know, make difficult choices as to what gets tested and what didn't. So we can work within the resources and the time that we had.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
That's probably not very eloquent, but
no,
a bit of a mental. It was tough, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I wonder, it sounds like you're building out a model, or I'm what's bubbling up in my head is just perhaps a simple comparison table of like life in the early stage startup mode and what that means for our profession or things that happen and what we should be aware of. And then on the other side, there's a table, you know, more of the, hey, this company is fully established. Maybe it's in a highly regulated industry. Just like a comparison table. I wonder if that would be, I'd certainly find that interesting, just to sort of see the subtleties of what folks might expect if they go from one to the other, and how the other can support the other, if that makes sense. So I'm sure, you know, in the world of early stage startups, there's lots of approaches that could help folks who perhaps are in industries that are a bit more slower paced, or there's more kind of red tape or structure and all that stuff, and the other way around as well. Maybe there's something there, Paul. What do you think?
I suppose there is. I mean, I have to state the limits of my knowledge. I mean, I've never worked anywhere that's really early stage, which is literally, you know, just founders and maybe one or two devs. I've never worked anywhere that's, say, pre-VC funding.
Gotcha.
And once companies start to expand and they hire, then they start, you know, dealing with things. Well, they should anyway. Start dealing with things like putting in processes regarding QA, start dealing with technical debt. Often when you're very early stage and you go, you carry a lot of technical debt because you just need to get things out quickly. And they can be a very rough around the edges because you're basically not releasing to a large number of customers yet. And often you're only doing it to, you know, get something out to investors.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe just get a few users on. There is some, for example, there's something that is quite popular in the startup community now called do things that don't scale. So the idea is get something out, even if you have to like do things in the back end yourself to make everything work every time a customer signs on. Because the important thing is having something out fast and to customers than having a complete system.
Absolutely.
But that carries a lot of technical debt and carries a lot of bugs as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. Well, Paul, let's get Christine and Natalia are waiting patiently with their hands up. So I think they want to join in on this conversation. So Christine, let's bring both Christine and Natalia up. And then Christine, if you go for it, because I think you'd put your hand up first, please do jump on in.
Hello.
Hey, Christine, welcome. Christine, it appears. Ah, yes. Yeah. I can hear you now, loud and clear.
The button is always important. LinkedIn is automatically unmuting you when you join the conversation. Always
it
important.
Is. It's the mute button.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation because I've been in startups a lot, not early stage. I still most of the times have at least like 3 or 4 developers. Right now, my team is also like 10 developers. But I know the struggle when you have to like figuring out, especially the risk management, how much you can get out versus how much you actually have to hold back. Because based, like, our profession is all about, like, the product quality is the most important thing, and the startup environment is just of, like Paul said, shipping out fast and quickly. And I thought about that to myself, especially this week, because we had a bug which we didn't caught and which caused us performance issues. And I thought to myself, how could have we done this better? And how can have, because we have the issue, we don't have enough time for manual testing, and we have a lot of automation. But in the end, especially when it comes down to money involvement and transaction involvements, you always will have that 10% where you want to do regression tests. And I'm thinking more and more about myself, how can I make that process, this 10%, in a way that either A, the whole team just spends half an hour in a way that everybody follows a specific test case or test plan, or I don't know, or if it in a way makes sense that I spend 2 hours on this, but then it's still only my view. Eh? I'm debating team approach versus me alone approach. And it's boggling my mind this week. Like, how could we have found it better? Let's say it like that.
Yeah, I'm hearing you, Christine. It's fascinating. And I think that, Rosie Sherry put out a poll the other day on the club around test cases. And that kind of, the reason I think about that is, as you say, Christine, like, where is that, or how do you make it valuable where it's like, hey, let's get all the team, they pick up a few cases each time, and that just gives us that extra bit of confidence. Yet it doesn't, you know, we're not beholden to these cases, and it's not all of our effort, as you say, it's 10% or 30 minutes where everyone follows a specific plan. An understanding where, I guess, as you say, like, the company is at, what its goals are, what its appetite for risk is, what it's really trying to achieve as a business, and then us in our profession trying to reconcile that. Because it came up yesterday, actually, during the test exchange. I put a question out saying, are bugs our friends? And the options were yes, no, or it's complicated. And I was like, it is complicated, right? Like, if we're not finding bugs, then, you know, we're thinking, are we doing our job properly? But, like, sometimes we don't want to find bugs because we're like, hey, we've got to ship this thing. We've got to get it out. We've got to get feedback. We've got to, you know, observe what's going on. We've got to test our assumptions in production. That's the only true way. So, yeah, it is complicated, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, you completely have it on the right, because you're also not sure, especially, like, you're testing it and it's maybe, like, especially you're refactoring and you always think, now, there should be a bug somewhere, but then everything goes smoothly. It just... it gives me, for me personally, gives me a better feeling if I have it documented, that I know everybody did specific things. We have it all documented, even if it sounds very conservative thinking. But for me, if that's all documented, then I know also if we now find a bug after production, we just have to look back and figure out, was our approach maybe wrong? Did we not do it in the right? Because we are all humans in the end. Hey, we all humans. We all make, like, it's not a mistake, but maybe we thought, yeah, the right way is better than the left way, or clicking that button once or twice. We never, and also we can never anticipate users. That's what I learned in all these years. They can be very creative when it comes down to how to use an application. So I'm still, yeah, I will look at what Rosie posted, because I still believe there has to be, like, a mixed approach of that somehow. But for startups, it's always time, money, it's always difficult.
Yeah. And just the reflection on your point about documentation, you know, I kind of feel like whenever we're writing stuff or capturing stuff about our testing efforts, and maybe even if that involves just checking off a list, it's still a form of history. We're still capturing a moment in time, which I think is important to capture and use that as either a reflection point, or we never come back to it. That's fine. Just the act of capturing that stuff, I think, has value, because we're making an effort, not just for the sake of it. I think if there's something about documentation. So I often think it's analogous to what we do at Ministry of Testing as a community, where, so every day I will write notes about what I observe in the community. And I'm using, I guess, my skills from the days where I would do dedicated exploratory testing sessions, and I would observe things, I'd write what I observe, who said what, the good things that's happening. And I come back to these notes and they're so useful, like, literally form, you know, for example, the conversation we have at the start of This Week in Testing, it forms the newsletter, it forms ideas, it generates things for us to put out to the community to co-create and collaborate. So I think documentation can go beyond itself of just being documentation for documentation's sake. So yeah, got me thinking about that one, Christine. Thank you. Paul, you unmuted. Feel free to jump on in.
Yeah, thanks. Great points, Christine. Thank you. Very much agree with what you said. I would take it further. I think that it's quite possible for bugs to reach production, even really serious ones, and it not be anyone's fault. It not be a process. The truth is that the testing is a best effort. We don't even pretend to be able to cover all the scenarios that we want. And certainly for startups, you just don't have the time to implement everything. Even with larger companies, it's very, very hard. So there are always going to be gaps in testing, and there are certain things that we're always going to have to live with. You know, certain things reach production. You know, the company I work for, we're a bit sort of prosaic about it, or I don't know the right word. Basically, we have an attitude of things are going to reach production, you know, despite the best efforts of the testers and the team. The best thing we can do is get them fixed very quickly. You know, get patches out, get hotfixes out as quickly as possible to deal with them. And therefore, we don't have this. I think the danger is that, and I've worked in a couple of places, not recently, certainly not the last couple of jobs that are like this, but I worked in places where basically if you find a bug, everyone reacts in an explosive manner. People start shouting at each other. People start saying, how did this happen? Who am I supposed to fire? You know, all these sorts of, people start saying everything's going to fail. You know, and therefore it makes you almost, what is it, fearful of finding something. Because you know that if you do, you know, somebody else is going to get shouted at. You know, even worse, I've had a boss in my early stage of my career say, I gave her a list of bugs that were found in the system. And she said, right, can you group them by developer? I want to know which developer I need to tell off.
Oh, yikes, Paul. That's an unfortunate situation. Yeah, absolutely. Let's bring Natalia. Thank you for waiting so patiently up on stage, Natalia. Yeah, feel free to jump on in. Thank you.
Afternoon, everyone. I just wanted to say from the beginning to Paul, you are not alone. There's a lot of testers out there who worked or working in the same environment where it's very full of uncertainty, particularly in startups. So thanks for sharing that. I think a lot of people will relate to that. I still work in a company that is not a startup, but behaves as a startup, right? Which means not in a way that maybe where you are, which means we're going very, very fast. And sometimes we testing in production, like the features or even our ideas. So we're not putting out there 100% product. Sometimes it could be not even 80, but something that we really need to test and see how it is. And on the other side is we accept a lot of risks. And even on the early days when I start working, we didn't use any kind of risk-based techniques, anything like that. Like I said, the danger of this is we accept a lot of risks and we fix forward because it's very easy for us to roll out any fix. We don't have any delivery manager, anyone who would be having a process, maybe also very loose process, allowed us to do many things, but also not knowing what actually those things could be or how they can impact. And that's why we accepted a lot of risks. But there is also a point where we wish we couldn't do that anymore because you roll out very fast, you can't scale, you test it, you put product working for some users, but doesn't work for other users because you don't have time to think about everything. Implementation stage we were better, but planning and thinking about possible cases, user base, or who can use it, we were not very good in that. So there is a moment when you might slow down and put some processes. And I think it's a great environment for testers or anyone to to bring up their experiences and set up processes to teach people what it is, to open up them like different world of things have they can do with more confidence or more transparency or feel more in control. You know, so it's also like you need to like hard to find your role in this environment, right? Because you know that going to be possibly potential bugs in production. And I had a lot of bugs in production and I know why, because of lack of time or process or not enough space to think. But we created an environment where it's like not even testers, it's not testers' fault and nobody's, it's a team need to sit down and think about why it happened, whether it's once or is a pattern. If it's a pattern, yes, let's see how we can think and fix. If it's once, yes, it happens. But yeah, it's a great opportunity in terms of like setting up then for future, right? Like this phase will pass. You will possibly get funding and scale and build more sustainable infrastructure and development. And there you go. You will know everything and you will just say like, hey, let's do this way. Yeah, so I hope there will be opportunity for you to shine rather than kind of having a bit of struggle, like you said, the minute.
Oh, thanks so much, Natalia. I appreciate that. I mean, I'm not really struggling. I just want to establish. I mean, I do the job well, and like to think, and you know, we have got processes that are being improved. You know, it's just one of these things. But you know, it's good to know that others, you know, going through similar things and have different similar perspectives.
Yeah, go for it, Paul. Sorry, I interrupted you there. Please.
Saying, I think there's Vijay in the listening group wants to come up.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get Vijay. Just to reiterate, and thanks so much for sharing that, Natalia. You know, I guess anyone who shares anything up on stage like this is for the audience as well as those up on stage. And it's great that we can share our experiences. So thank you for continuing to do that. But yeah, as you say, Paul, let's get Vijay up on stage. Vijay, welcome.
Saying it's probably quite busy with five people on the stage, so I'll drop down, but thank you so much.
Okay, Paul, thanks so much for joining us. Cheers.
Yeah, can you hear me? Hello?
I can hear you loud and clear. Vijay, how's your week in testing been?
Oh, yeah, that's great. You guys have got good discussion going. Recently I did speak at Starvest, you know, here in US. And I had a talk on risk-based testing. I can, you know, relate to all of the discussions, you know, you had and everybody was talking about. One thing, and I in my LinkedIn profile, I also have a 20-minute video that kind of covers, you know, some of the processes that I have followed through my career, you know, at many different companies, like, you know, a startup or a mid-scale or a very large-scale companies. And so kind of I've distilled, you know, all that into 20 minutes in a session, right? And the one key thing that's very important is like learning like the minimum viable, you know, requirement to launch the product, right? There could be like hundreds of you know, features, but maybe among them, like, you know, 5 or 10 would be very important, you know. Understanding that would be a good exercise as a QA, you know, person, you know, who's in charge. And sometime in startup, you kind of don't get that, you know, because it's not much of a process. So what I have found is that, you know, instead of like, I mean, if you don't get it, you create it yourself saying, hey, I feel that, you know, these are my MVP based on like the discussions I had or the minimum documents that I have seen around, and have a, you know, a review, you know, with all the stakeholders, like, And at that point, you get, you know, a feedback that, oh, no, this is not that, you know, this is what it should be, right? So that's one way to get the details if it is not clearly out there, you know. So minimum viable feature is the one thing. Other one is like, you know, if you had like, you know, 20 different features, you know, and you have a team of people, you know, have them kind of, you know, go through each of the, you know, 20 different things, you know, in the first day, you know, like don't get stuck in the first thing, you know, that you start, you know. So that way you get a quick feel of, you know, how things are, you know, across, right? And then, you know, based on where you see the risk. So like sometimes, you know, you'll see that some big change has gone in and things are breaking, you know, left and right, you know, in one feature. So maybe you can do like a kind of a focus-based testing on that area to see, you know, where the issues are. So, and then there are more other techniques like, you know, companies here in US are following like, you know, large companies like Google, you know, Meta and all, is that they call it fish fooding, dog fooding, where, you know, it's like, you know, eat your own, you know, food, right? So in fish fooding, you go with a small amount of people, you know, within your company who are, you know, knowledgeable about the product, and ask them to have a test drive, you know. And then, you know, dog fooding is kind of like, if you have the capabilities, you know, you can do it yourself, or there are like third party companies, you know, based on, you know, how your product works, you know, that you can use them. Let's say you don't have all the, you know, PCs or a Mac or, a, you know, source devices, you know, there are companies that give you that, and you can give them some, you know, guidelines of test cases, and they would, you know, reach out and, you know, to their own, you know, user base and kind of give you the feedback, you know. So these are some techniques I've done. I've, you know, spoke quite a bit, but definitely if you are interested in what I spoke, you can go and look at my video and, you know, it's all captured there.
That's wonderful, Vijay. That's a whole treasure trove of information you shared. So thank you so much. What I'd also recommend, feel free to post a link to your video as a comment on this event page. You're more than welcome to do that, and then folks can get easy access to check it out. Christine and Natalia, any further thoughts on this particular topic, perhaps reflecting on some of the things that Vijay has shared as well?
I like the term fish fooding and dog fooding. I never heard that. And I wonder, and the whole time I wonder, can we use tools for this? Can we use somehow tools to make parts of this process easier? I shouldn't say easier, maybe faster, more efficient, because like we spoke about documentation, I loved your comment on that documentation, not for just the documentation thing, but still writing these things takes time and takes effort. And most of the time it needs at least I feel like this, what we also heard from Paul, like the experience, the more experienced we are, the better. It's just how that is. We're writing also better test cases or however we want to call it, or test scripts or something. It is just the more experience you get the groove out of this. But is there something we can use to help even for like, especially in startup teams, you cannot always hire the senior QA. You have to go also with junior QAs, which is completely fine. But how can we help that? Is the community, do we need, like, the community helped me always. I love the Ministry of Testing community, because no matter what I'm asking, I'm always getting incredible feedback. So shout out to all of you. I love this so much. But I wonder if you not have yet the access to that, or somehow you maybe not doing it, what tools are there out to help in that?
It's a great question and reflection. Christine, Natalia, go for it.
Do you to follow up on this, Christine, I use my team and my company. You know, so like for different like test cases and understanding how the best we can test the feature, I discuss them and I share what I think, and they will challenge me or say like, oh, but what would happen if this user comes in, or this test data or anything, so, and we add on top of it. I don't do this in isolation. I try to, of course, there will be some times when I just need to do that. It's part of my job and just share them. On the bigger releases, I do bug blitzes and then invite all my company to take part. And I will follow up with them just to get as much as I can. Like the challenge is to set up a clear process, how to set up everything and what you want to get out and how you want to follow up later. But I guess it's depending like whether you have an access to other people, like departments, particularly know your team, something outside, right? Like marketing or a commercial. So I have an access to them and I will use them as my beta testers. And I will praise them later. So it's kind of like having a good partnership with people in the company really helps you to have an access to different resources, people. I don't like calling people resources, people and minds.
That's wonderful advice, Natalia. Makes me also think about the power of personas, where if our constraint is we don't have anyone else that we could call on to do, say, excuse me, some fish fooding or dog fooding, maybe we can create some personas and try our very best as professionals to step into those personas and become someone that we're not. To, you know, they think and feel in a different way, they experience things a different way, they have different desires and needs. And you know, what state of mind they're in when they're using this particular thing, like literally create a character, like maybe you would in a story or a play, and you become that character to then kind of force yourself to become someone else. And, you know, that I guess is perhaps one way. If you don't have, as you say, Natalia, awesome if you can get access to folks within your team and also outside of your engineering team as well. Vijay, it sounds yes, like so, you're going to say something. Please go for it.
No. I was just saying that, you know, I kind of agree with what Natalia said. And, you know, reaching out within the company, you know, and finding, you know, people who want to help, you know, in the quality, right, is definitely a way. Customer support is also another team that kind of tell you, like, what are the customer pain points, you know, if you had product already out there, you know, or they might also know, you know, what to expect, right? So they are also good people to, like, kind of, you know, be friendly with, or, and sometimes you can help them, you know, because they are also looking, right, that if customer reports some issue, you know, what do I do, you know, or how do I, you know, kind of respond to them. And as a QA, you have like a great deal of knowledge, right, that, hey, you know, do this, or this is a non-issue, right? So kind of creating that, you know, like a trust currency, you know, with them kind of helps you in the longer run. So, but I mean, there are many ways. If you have the budget, then there are like companies, you know, they will give you, a quote, you know, how much it costs. So like you can go to your, you know, stakeholder and say, hey, you know, we are, you know, we don't have all this, you know, resources, but a third party can do it, you know, and it costs you like $10,000, you know, is it okay, you know? So at least in my, you know, this thing, I have used a company called Novus, you know, they're based in Oregon, you know, USA. There's also a company called Centerpoint, you know, so there are many, many companies. They do like a community-based, you know, they have community-based like, you know, resources, or, you know, it's kind of like a freelancers that they reach out to kind of give you a very, you know, a concise report, you know, of how it went, you know. So, but I think it kind of like whatever works, like, you know, sometimes startups are very small, you don't have the budget, or then you go the other way around. If you have the budget, then, you know, you can look into, you know, like a third party, you know. But it's a juggling act, you know.
Absolutely, Vijay. And thank you so much for sharing. Good discussion here. Now we have Nerv P waiting with their hand up. So let's bring them up. Thank you for waiting so patiently there. Nerv, am I pronouncing your name correctly, or would I pronounce it NRV? Okay, let's see. You are on mute at the moment, so I'll just wait a little bit to see if we can get your audio fixed up and get you up on stage and unmuted.
Hello, I'm Audu.
Yay, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Thanks for asking. So, my name pronunciation is Nirav. You can call me Nirav.
Nirav.
It is just my first time that I'm attending this event with Ministry of Testing. So I would like to thank the management to let me in to this really very qualified and important meeting. Right. So my question is very quick. Like, if we compare the manual and the automation test methodologies in the industry, right? Some sort of the people, they're stuck in the manual and they are not able to move to the automation, right? And I'm recently going through some scenarios where I'm comparing Selenium and Playwright, where I found a sort of so many things that is easy doing in Playwright, while Selenium is a very stable in the market. So I would like to know your thoughts on this. Why we choose Selenium, Playwright over Selenium. So if you can help me with that.
Great question, Nirav, and thank you so much for joining the stage. And okay. It's very, very cool to have you here, and welcome to This Week in Testing. You're more than welcome to join us anytime and in all the various places that we hang out at Ministry of Testing. Christine, any thoughts on this?
Oh, that's a big one. My thoughts, because I have to say, I switched testing frameworks in every company I ever worked in, because I always, for me, choosing an automation framework depends on my team a lot, because I love the whole team approach from Lisa. So I always want them to writing as well. So for me, it's very important that it is the programming language they're using for developing the product. So I'm currently using Playwright because it was also initiated by the developers because they found it interesting, and I like it as well. But I started my journey with Selenium, and you're completely correct. It is a very stable one, but it's always comes down, or at least I find it. The question is, when you're self-learning, that is a little bit more difficult because you have to think about, okay, where I want to join. I think for me, but I know, or like, how can I say that? For me,
Sorry to interrupt you here. Let's say when we are writing a code in the Selenium, right, it takes 40 lines. When we are doing it the same with a Playwright, it takes almost around 20 lines. So there are a lot many things that has been changed in the Playwright. So correct me if I'm wrong.
No, it is. It is definitely. The question is always, if you have everything based out of Selenium, how much will it cost to migrate to Playwright? I'm not sure if there are already tools out for that or is not. For me, learn one testing framework good, and then you can use this knowledge and apply it to a lot of other testing frameworks. Like in my talk I'm going to have on the Test Bash, I will take people through the journey from I used Cypress and Nightwatch before, and now I'm learning Playwright, but because I learned them, I learned them completely. I'm using AI, and I'm very honest with that, to help me with, for example, the syntax, because I'm very bad in syntax. So I know how it's written in Cypress, and I'm just asking it, okay, how do I write that in that? And then, or I have an error, especially error handling, and I'm asking this as well. And in my talk, I'm going to explain this a little bit, because I believe we have to use AI now to help. But my first and foremost tip is check first, learn one and learn it good, and then you can apply that knowledge to others. if you guys having right now Selenium, I don't know how difficult it is to migrate to Play, right? Because I never done much migration, like I said. But maybe some other folks have some ideas, because I don't know how easy it is to get or to run both at the same time. That's, I heard a lot of times it's not a good approach, and I never done this. But that would be my statements to that.
Wonderful advice there, Christine. Thank you so much. There are, just doing a quick time check, let's continue with this for another few minutes. I see that we have Mohammed and Paul both have their hands up. Perhaps they have some thoughts to share on this topic as well, Nirov. So let's bring them up on stage and we'll go from there.
Okay, thank you guys. Well, it's very nice to hear from Christine. And yes, Christine, I'll definitely follow your advice and I'll do needful to implement an automation. So that's all. Thank you very much. You can bring the next member. Thank you, Simon, and thanks, everyone.
Okay, Nirov, thanks so much. Mohammed, feel free to jump straight in if you've got some thoughts on this topic.
Hi, hello, sure. Everyone. Okay, so my question is to Cristiano. I have 7 years of experience as a manual QA engineer, with international organization, but I'd want to switch to automation. So from last few months, I just practicing using the Selenium, but it's really difficult for me to switch from manual to automation, and it's difficult for me. For example, companies are not considering me because my experience is around 6 plus years. So what suggestion you people give me, or give me some track so that I will move to automation side? Thank you.
Yeah, that is a difficult one. I find it very interesting because I currently look for somebody in mainly manual testing, because we are lacking in our comp, we're not lacking it, but I want the support from we have the lack of test strategies and test management. So I'm actually looking more right now, not for automation, because I do the automation and we have enough, and two would not fulfill it right now. But I understand the switch, because I switched from manual testing also to test automation, but there was just, for me, because I loved programming. I loved, the first time ever I had Hello World appearing, that just changed my world. And I'm just so, I love coding, I love creating so much. And I love that we create and test automation. Basically, that's how I always explain to people, robots, which test other people's code, and that my code is basically, it's not the product, but it helps the product quality. How to learn it the best. I love the 30 days of testing, the challenges Ministry of Testing has. And I have to, and I'm doing a lot of advertising here for Ministry of Testing, but I have to really say, I love these challenges. I love also, I think last year or the year before, you had a conference where you had automation challenges as well. I can, either Simon, you can share it, because you had I remember that Mark did this, had this website with the booking thing, and you guys put the automation challenge up to automate it, because when you learn automation for yourself, it's always difficult to find a website to test it on and to basically have a repository to always be working on, because you have to learn it. And I love that you guys had that website. And it's also, there is a PHP website also, which you can learn, because I learn by doing. It's just purely learning by doing. I have such big problems reading books and doing courses. And I'm learning by doing, I'm trying it, and then I'm just Googling my way through, or now using different AIs for this. And that would be my approach. Look at the 30 days of testing, at the automation challenge, I think is what's called, that helped me the most, I have to say.
Okay, thank you. I will try.
That's wonderful.
Good luck.
It's wonderful advice, Christine. And yeah, thank you for promoting all the things. I'm very, very grateful for that. I'm just actually trying to find, we put out a poll a while back related to automation. I'm just trying to get the right number before I share it incorrectly, but it was roughly about 50% of people agreed that they feel inadequate without automation skills. So, Mohammed, I just want to say you're not alone. There is this sense of pressure that people feel like they need to become, you know, incredible coding experts to be able to succeed as a testing QA or quality engineering professional. And there are options, And as you know, Christine shares, if there's real joy in coding and you can find that, like, go for it, right? That's awesome. There are other options to explore as well. Plenty of stuff on ministryoftesting.com, as Christine has mentioned. There are some previous episodes of the Testing Planet. I believe it was the first episode that we ran a few months ago. You can find that on ministrytesting.com. A number of people had a good discussion about the world of automation and kind of thinking about how we can upskill and some of the challenges that we all face when it comes to that. And also kind of how to keep sharp with our core skills as testing professionals and keeping on top of them as well. So yeah, please do get involved with the community, and very, very much appreciate you coming up on stage today.
Like, I have one more question, like, if you allow me.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Okay. So like, I did ISTQB certified at initial level, so which is basic. So what should I will do, like, for the certification? Like, what is like my next target? So related to the certification. Yeah, what I am thinking is related to some like PM or related to the testing, what I will like do.
Great question. Well, I have a bias as I'm part of Ministry of Testing, but I would recommend the Ministry of Testing Foundation Certificate in Test Automation. There's also an intermediate and advanced course as well. That's worth checking out. We're getting some good feedback from folks who are taking that, at least those who are very much new to the world of test automation. It gives them the foundation. It gives them lots of principles. It doesn't just jump in and say, hey, learn this tool, or let's go into this tool in detail. It helps people get the core skills they need to succeed with test automation. So those are worth checking out. Of course, there are plenty of other stuff and courses out there, but for sure, I would recommend the one that's been created with the community via ministryoftesting.com. So you can find that. If you go to ministryoftesting.com/certifications, you should be able to find the foundation certificate.
Okay, thank you so much.
I have to just quickly jump into this, because for me, it's really important, because especially also when I hear that the survey showed that 50% feel that test automation is a skill I have to learn and they don't feel adequate. I strongly believe, especially AI, we see Copilot and Copilot and all these other things. AI is not yet ready to become coder, not at all. Like, I tried it out and it's just very, you have to like small code lines, yada, yada, but it will get better and better and better and better and better. And I believe the skills we have as quality assurance engineer, as manual testers, or whatever you want to call the quality assurance space, the critical thinking, the ability to read requirements and to also figure out what is, like what we heard before, the risk management, all these, and also keeping product quality up, this is something AI will not be able to do, because AI will value whatever input they had and will maybe do analysis, but there is a human factor around it. And I really want to ensure that we don't feel the pressure. I understand that a lot of companies want the automation skills right now, and I'm trying in my company also to try to teach them, yes, automation skills are nice and fine. But what I read right now, somebody is test strategies, that we are on the big scale when we're scaling up, that we are prepared for this. And this is such a value. Like, I am inadequate for this. I'm very bad in doing this. And I need some, like, and it's such a valuable skill to have this critical thinking, these thoughts AI will not be able to do. So I still believe we have to bring a change also in startups to show them that we are high valuable skilled laborers. And if we don't have automation skills, we are still high valued and high skilled to help keeping product quality up. Because like I said before, the 10% we're doing in the end in manual testing, and we always will do this. If this is somebody who has a lot of experience, they will not need the 90% of the time where we allocate it. No, they need less amount of time because of their experience and because of their critical thinking and because the way maybe they sources out to cloud testing, I don't care, but you still need a manager to do this. So I really want to encourage everybody, if you don't like coding or if it's just so difficult, see how you can find ways to embrace how, because you're all incredibly clever people. And we just have to find a way that CTOs and product managers think a little bit that not just everybody can do testing. That's not how it is. Yes, everybody can do it, but not everybody can do it as compact and as comprehensive, maybe, as we do it. As a last statement to that, it was important for me to get out.
Wow, absolutely, Christine. And thank you so much for sharing that. Incredible advice, and I'm very grateful for everything you shared during this week in testing. Thank you, Mohammed, for your question. Lovely to have you up on stage. And apologies to those that haven't had a chance to get up on stage today. We have come to the end of today's This Week in Testing. Super grateful for your time. Always a pleasure and privilege to host. And we've had some wonderful conversations. So do keep those conversations coming. Let's continue to take action. You know, we as an industry, we can move things forward in a positive direction. We can continue to support each other. We have to. There's no other way, right? We have to reach out to each other, connect and learn and discover what's possible. So let's keep that going. And in the meantime, for all things community and Ministry of Testing, there's always good stuff to be found over at ministryoftesting.com. I'd recommend, again, signing up to the newsletter. For those that aren't signed up to that, head over to ministryoftesting.com/newsletter. You'll get a summary of all the things that have been happening every week, including all the events that we're hosting. So we've got a number of various events happening all the time, and meetups popping across the globe, which is very exciting. Let's leave it there for today. Thank you so much for your time, everyone. Please do enjoy the rest of your day and have a lovely weekend. Bye for now.